Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Chris Slayer, 26 years of career experience, Battalion Chief for the City of Mesa Fire and Medical Department. Chris actually wanted to be a police officer. While volunteering for a local sheriff's department, he was able to meet firefighters who explained to Chris the skills he had in mountain rescue most definitely translates to fire departments. With that being said, the wheels started spinning for Chris and he applied to Phoenix and Mesa. Mesa was faster out the gate, and Chris never looked back. I want the listeners to hear Chris's experience regarding the passion he has now didn't develop until later on in his career, and most importantly, how the delivery you choose when exposed to new ideas you want to bring back to your own organization can have a negative effect if not done properly. Two quotes stuck out for me in our conversation. The first is, "Risk is managed by competence," and the second is, "Values dictate culture." With that, I present Chris Slayer.
So how I got into the fire service, I wanted to be a cop. And I started volunteering out of college. I used to be a pretty avid rock climber and mountaineer. So during that process, I started volunteering with the local sheriff's department, the Maricopa County Sheriff's Department, on their Central Arizona Mountain Rescue Association. So they call it CAMRA, their mountain rescue team. And we're doing a bunch of helicopter ops, high angle rescue. And the guys I started to meet were all firefighters. And they said, "Hey, you know, firefighters have technical rescue teams. We get paid to do this. Usually the police do not. You know, it's volunteer. Maybe you should consider fire if this is the route you want to go." So started showing some interest, riding along. And one of the testing opportunities came up. You know, we kind of run a circuit here in the valley. You know, everybody hires right around the same, you know, couple months. So I put in an application with Phoenix Fire, and I put in an application with Mesa Fire. And during that time frame, Phoenix, it took a long time to get anything back from them. So Mesa Fire was Scantron. I went in and took my exam. And when I left, they handed me, "Hey, you passed your exam. You are invited to a physical agility. And so here's your physical agility date." Passed my physical agility. They said, "Here's your first interview date." And so I went to my first interview. This is all within, you know, a couple weeks of each other. Passed my first interview. They circled highly qualified. Passed my second interview. And I was offered a position in Mesa before I even got notification that I had passed Phoenix's test, and I was invited to their physical agility. Mm-hmm. So I had some friends on Phoenix that said, "Hey man, Mesa's a really good department. It's going places. So stay where you're at." That would be my recommendation. And so I stayed. So I've been there for 26 years.
Okay. For those that don't know, including myself, can you tell us about the city of Mesa, the size, engines, trucks, things of that nature?
For sure. So the city of Mesa is about 139 square miles. We have 22 fire stations. Right now we're building 23 and 24. We run four battalions. We have about 500 online firefighters, and then we just put in several more ambo transportation units. So we're over 56 units now, 24 engines, 6 ladders, and we have medical response units that are a 4-person crew, and then we have ambulances that are 2-person. All of our rides are ALS. We run 2 paramedics on every single truck. And it's super unique here in the valley too. So Brunacini used to be the chief of Phoenix Fire. Mm-hmm. And years ago, the city of Mesa has its own dispatch center, and the city of Phoenix has their own dispatch center. But collectively, our 136 miles that we cover in Mesa, we also dispatch for several other entities, I think 6 others. Phoenix does 26 others. So combined, we cover over 2,000 miles of space. We all work off one set of SOPs, every agency, and there are no city boundaries at all. So we all work off global positioning. I can see every unit on my computer-aided dispatch system, and they can see myself. We communicate on the same channels. So that being said, our area can get rather large because of that automatic aid system. We technically don't have a mutual aid request. We just go because we're the closest unit on global positioning. So it's the gold standard response model for sure. I didn't know that didn't exist everywhere until I started, until I started teaching and getting outside the organization. The system we have is pretty impressive. And we're spoiled rotten. We really have a good organization where they take care of us. We have full-time behavioral health people. We've get two sets of turnouts, so we swap them out after every fire. They wash them immediately. Our cancer risk reduction, our mental health stuff is all top-notch. I mean, we're really, really far ahead in the valley compared to a lot of agencies. So it's I'm blessed to work for the city that I work for, without a doubt.
And what's your minimum staffing across the engines and ladders?
So 4-person minimum staffing, two of
Four.
those are paramedics. Yep.
Okay.
And that's across the board. And
Okay.
that's everywhere here in the regional valley, where the
Okay.
same order model.
And that one vehicle you said that's not an ambulance, but response to medicals that carries four.
Four people. Yep. The
How many of
medical
those do you
response
have?
units. Oh, shoot. I think there's six of them now.
Okay.
So they're not an all hazards unit like an engine, but they'll run a lot more of the medical calls.
Okay. And is it a requirement to be an ALS provider as an individual to promote?
No, it is not.
It is not.
So,
Okay.
no, you don't have to be ALS. And in fact, I've been BLS my whole career, right? Better lifestyle.
Okay. All
Yep.
right. And I definitely I heard you talking about that your CAD system on Corley Scrap podcast. And no, you're right, because to this day, which is sad to say, in 2025, we have jurisdictions, departments that you don't come in my sandbox unless I request you, and you can't bid in my first due area for calls. And it's like, at the end of the day, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, they're the ones suffering from that. While you have chiefs that are playing ego, and
Correct.
it's not a help for anybody.
No, we've got to lose that. If I can see one thing, if I could snap my fingers right now and change one thing in the fire service, that's what it would be. Get rid of the city boundaries, do what's right for the public, and we'll get past the little things. So, and there's some growing pains. If you don't have the same staffing model, like I gave an example, Tempe Fire, which borders our jurisdiction, used to run BLS ladder trucks. So, running out of my old station, we'd run into their jurisdiction at 2 in the morning because they'd special call us because we have paramedics and they needed to transfer that call. So now I got to take a ladder out of my system to take their patient to the hospital. Well, that didn't ever go really well, but the guys in the field would get angry about it. But I'm like, hey, it's above our pay grade. We can express our concerns to senior staff. We can express our concerns to, our assistant chiefs, up to the chief, or who has to take it to both city managers, and both fire chiefs have to collectively say, okay, can we afford this? Is this in our budget operationally? Yes or no, but we don't want to jeopardize that minimum staffing. We don't want to jeopardize automatic aid, and we certainly want to provide the best, external customer service as well as internal customer service, within this response plan. So, but
Okay.
yeah, we've got to get over that and fix it.
Definitely, definitely. All right. So Mesa, you apply for Mesa, they're like, hey, come on board, you come on board. I'm assuming you have to do some sort of recruit class rookie school before you got signed off, correct?
We do. So in the valley, again, there used to be four, but now there are five regional academies. We all teach very similar stuff, very minor differences just because of equipment and stuff like that. You have to attend one of those regional academies to work for one of the agencies. It's 16 to 18 weeks, depending on that budget cycle or how many people are involved in the academy. And once you're out of the academy after that 16, 18 week period, you're on a year probation.
Okay.
So.
Okay. So, stepping through those doors, what was it like for you? What was recruit class like? And then once you graduated, what was your first assignment and what was that feeling like walking through those doors?
Oh man, you're jogging my memory now. That was 26 years ago. So I started on my 25th birthday, January 11th, 1999. So that was the best birthday present that I ever got. And I didn't realize the scope of, the fire department at the time. I was just, hey man, chicks dig it, and we're gonna get more, we're gonna get more ass than a toilet seat. But it's a, it that's the way we went into this. The culture's changed now, but that's kind of what we were, I was thinking back then. It was just fun. The guys that I met are lifelong friends. The kitchen table, turns out to be the best thing ever in the fire service, once you get on the job. But recruit class was awesome. Just to generate those bonds and go through that, go through that with the guys and girls that I came on with was pretty outstanding. It gave me some fundamentals and a really good foundation to what I was going to expect out there. And then, of course, you just grow, right? There, my training chief, Brady Leffler, and Gabe Cezotti at the time, Brady pulled me aside and he's like, "Hey, Chris, I'm going to give you some career advice. I still use it to this day." He said, "Don't sweat the small things, and it's mostly small things. If it's not going to matter in 5 years, think about it before you say something." So I've always kind of taken that with me, through the years, and he's not wrong. So after I graduated from the academy, we do 3 months or 4 months rotations, depending on, the
Okay.
class size again. So you'll go one station for, 3 months, and then rotate for 3 months, and then rotate for 3 months until you and get evaluated by each one of those captains. So once I'm out there, like I said, I just feel like I'm scratching the surface, you know what I mean, of what the job actually was. And I didn't get all in or all into the job until a little later in my career when I realized, hey, I didn't know, don't know what I don't know. So the downfall of the regional system here is that those five regional academies, unless you're RTOs and collectively we're getting out to these, micro conferences or big conferences and learning, our agencies are inbred. We
Absolutely.
tend not to grow because when I bring something back, it's not just bringing it back for my organization, it's bringing it back for the region. And we have this thing called the ROC, which is the Regional Operations Consistency Committee, and it's represented by all of these organizations. And to take something to that ROC, you need to start with the why we need to change this, because it's a big change. When you're talking about 900 stations collectively to get everything through training and stuff, that's a big battleship to turn. So.
Definitely. Okay. And so you mentioned that you found that extra step as far as learning and passion and actually giving a damn about the fire service later on in life. But before that happened, were you trying to seek out and find those guys you wanted to emulate, guys or gals that were into the job?
So not really. Again, I didn't know we were inbred. You know what I mean? And it's hard to look outside the box because you just don't know what you don't know,
Right.
right? So I stumbled on it. So and once I realized it, I was like, oh, I need to elevate my game. So that's how that took place. That all started right around probably 2014.
Okay. So it took because you got hired in 99 and it hit in 2014. Okay. So with that being said, at what point in your career did you decide to start moving up the ranks?
I was just a firefighter for about, what do I want to say, probably about 7 years, and then I promoted to engineer. So maybe less. So I promoted to engineer, our pump operator. We call them engineers, pump operator, fairly early in my career. And I got involved with technical rescue, hazmat right away. In 2001, during 9/11, I ran a heavy rescue hazmat combination hazmat TRT response. So we ran a lot of the white powder calls, a lot of the, terrorism threat calls and stuff like that. But that's kind of where I wanted my game to be, is that TRT, because that's where I started, right? The mountain rescue type of thing. And then I figured I'd test for captain. So yeah, that's probably my 4 year mark as engineer, and I tested for captain right at that 7 year mark. And I literally switched seats. It just happened to be my captain retired, and then when I got promoted, I went over from the driver's seat of engine 4 to the captain's seat of engine 204, and I had the same back seaters, and then I just replaced the engineer, that my position. So it was cool. I spent a large majority of my career doing the technical rescue station when I promoted, and I stayed captain for 17 years. So I really enjoyed that spot as running. We don't have lieutenants, so I know the hierarchy and some other agencies are different, but we don't have lieutenants. Yeah, I'd spent the majority of my career as captain, and I never wanted to test for BC. I never thought it would be interesting to me. But through the journey of change and looking to elevate my game and the department itself, I was like, okay, I think it's time for a change. Some of our leadership is failing us at this point, and I better step up. So that's why I decided to test for BC, and that's been about 4 years now.
Okay. All right. I'm gonna get back to that BC leadership quote that you mentioned, because I think that that needs to be definitely talked about. But before I get there, was there any particular motivation or reason why you're like, all right, I've done the driver role. I think I've got this. I'm ready to transition to that right front seat.
It's just the time. The timing was really good for me, personally and professionally, when a lot of doors were opening up. The department was growing quite a bit at that time. We had quite a bit of retirements, so the promotional list was a good opportunity. So that's one of the main reasons to do that. It wasn't about like me being a boss or running my own crew. I had some good mentorship back then and said, yeah, I think you're ready. Let me ride in the front seat a lot, just moving out of position. So that was nice. But there other than that, there was really no other mo outside motivation for me to bump up to captain.
Okay. And once you got that position, once you got the cap spot, what kind of captain did you want to be? Because I think most individuals, before they get to that spot or before they decide, yeah, I'm going to go that route, they've learned from the good, the bad, what they've seen, what they're like, I will try to never do that, hopefully. So when you got that role, what kind of leader did you want to be?
So I really didn't think about it very much, but you're right. There's a lot of that. My captain, and I love him to death. His name is Dan Broadley. He was kind of my mentor through the years. He taught me both what I didn't want to do and what I did want to do, right? So there were some things that I really loved, and that was his empowerment. Hey, jump up and do this, and I think you're ready for this. But he would stand back and not do a whole heck of a lot. So I would have liked to seen the, more opportunities to train, drill, get out and do some stuff. We went to Katrina together. So we got moved out to Katrina, and I just love the way he empowered us to be better. He took a really far back seat. Sometimes I thought maybe too far, but I'm not sure anymore. You know what I mean? Because I really did like the way he sat back and said, "Hey, you guys run it. I'm here to guide you professionally through your career." And I think that developed me as a person a lot. Now, when I got the captain, I really enjoyed training a lot. So, and again, I started at that TRT station, so my focus was heavy on technical rescue. So I took a month-long class for the, they call it the Arizona Vortex. I think people use it all over the country now. But did an advanced anchors class, advanced highline class, to the point where I was getting phone calls saying, "Hey, will you come out to Boston? Can you do these highlines for this technical rescue? Do you have anybody that can do that?" And I'm like, "My crew can." They're like, "I'm flying you all out." So we do technical rescue, and for other people, basically subcontract to do that. And I had a lot of fun. And then I had when I had my first kid. I was like, "Oh man, this is busy," because we were, like I said, we were dual tech, hazmat and TRT. So we not only had the city of Mesa training, we had regional training as well because we train and operate those guidelines. So it was really busy. So I decided I needed to slow down a little bit after I had kids for my personal life, and then went on to a slower station, which was engine 210. It's the last neighborhood fire station here. I mean, it's nestled in a park. We have basketball courts outside, so civilians come out and play. We got our Coke machine, and it's just nestled in a community. Super cool, not real busy. So it allowed us to train a lot. So we still got fires. We still run a fair amount of calls. I think it's over 2,000 calls a year now, that unit. It was just a neat little fire station to go with. There was only four people there, and per shift. So it was a good opportunity for me to start pushing in a different direction. And that's when I really got involved and made that switch from technical rescue to engine work.
Okay. You mentioned that everyone has seasons in life, but you mentioned, you started a family, you had a kid or two, and so you transitioned from where you're at to a slower station. And you have some individuals out there who poke fun or, you can't hang. And all, so what's your take on sometimes needing that break? Because I give it to the to like especially out west, San Francisco, that engine that's running 10,000 calls and those hard charges out there. If you can do that your whole career, God bless you. But sometimes for your mental, for your mental psyche, for yourself, you need to step back a little bit.
For sure. If and when I say slow, it's not that much slower,
Right.
but the other we were running a heavy rescue, a ladder and an engine out of that out of the first station. It was station 204. And going from something with 12 people there, or 8 or 12 people, to a station with four is time to switch off a little bit. You know what I mean? We have way slower stations out east, but there's nothing wrong with going slow if you need that work-life balance. If your family comes first, and if that impacts your sleep to where you can't be a good husband, you can't be, a good father, you can't attend things because you're moody or tired or whatever, then you need to get out of that headspace and move. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Definitely. Okay. All right. So when you quote unquote caught the bug, as far as you don't know what you don't know, were you a captain then? Okay.
I
And
was.
so with that being said, what took you to that next level? What occurred?
So we're in 2001. Not only did, of course, 9/11 happen in September, but before that, March 14th, Phoenix had an incident with Brett Tarver. And that fire was the first line of duty death in a long, long time in Arizona. And that particular event, we had 12 maydays on that fire. I don't know if you're familiar.
Ooh, I am.
We lost one life, which was Brett. John Thomason, who recently passed away from surgery complications, unfortunately, should have been the 13th mayday of that fire. And he was, really close and with Brett when he called his mayday. John went into respiratory rest on that event. So after that, the region started to look at our Mayday at response procedures and evaluate what we can do as far as a strategic level. and we had a bunch of vacant grocery stores. We all got to walk the Southwest supermarket. You know, Bruno did a really bang up job about getting everybody through there, walking us through the scenario, you know, telling us, you know, where the all the racks were down and all the goods and where the firefighters were and how they got out. Like, they did a really excellent job explaining that. So then we went back, and you can look a bunch of this stuff up on YouTube, but we went back and did 236 drills collectively, and we tried to get all of the data. And in 2002, we did, you know, RIT team in place, RIT team not in place, firefighters on the hose line, firefighters off the hose line. We did different scenarios and to see what time frames we were looking at. And so I kept all that data, and I started to do some research, and later on in 2012, we did a very similar drill, and we ran 42 drills. But this time, not only did we videotape it through a thermal imager, and we did it on a GoPro as well. And so we were able to do a couple things that we didn't achieve in 2002. One is I noticed the time frames were almost no different. We had not improved on our rescue time from 2002 to 2012. Our strategic plan got better, but our task and tactical plan stayed the same. So we started doing a little research and stuff like that, and that allowed me to go watch all 42 of those drills in the thermal imager and through the GoPro. I had audio so I could hear their communication. We timestamped everything from, did you separate the tools from the air on the RIT bag? Did you mark the hose line? Did you find out what hose line the firefighter was on before you made entry? What was your air at entry? What was your air at the 50-foot coupling? What was your air at the 100-foot coupling? When you reached the firefighter, what was your air, right? What was your communication at the firefighter? Did you package the firefighter? Did you transfill the firefighter? All that data was collected. So, and not only did we collect it, we put it on a poster board, which I still have around here somewhere. I would say, Danny, regardless of your engine company, you're number one on this list. And we did all of the engine companies that we drilled, but we didn't really mark their engine company. So I handed you the DVD and said, I need you to go back and evaluate this and give me your input. Tell me how you think you did. And then we could go back and look at it. And I could review all of the videos and see where we fell down, right? Where did we do great, and what didn't we do so great? So we took all of that information, and I came up with this plan to communicate, lack of communication, I guess. Purposeful communication is a better word for that, and purposeful movement. And we implemented in my agency. They vetted it, and we cut that firefighter rescue team down, or rescue stuff in half. So they wanted to put it to the test. They said, put your money where your mouth is. And they put one of the guys back there that I actually had come on with. He's a big dude, over 300 pounds, and all of his equipment. They put him under some OSB and drywall, like simulated collapse. They smoked up the building, and we ended up going 150 feet back in through the maze and getting him out in about 4 minutes. And we all had over half our bottles of air. So we took that back, we evaluated it, and we came up with a system while doing that. I started reading about line of duty deaths and mayday situations, and I kept coming across like flow path, heat release rate, and I kind of pushed it aside. I didn't feel like I needed to know that back in that time frame. But once I started seeing it so many times, because it was fairly new back then, it was the Weekend Firefighter with Derek Alconis and Steve Kerber on YouTube. You could probably still look that up. 2012, that we're right around 2014 now. And I'm like, oh, okay, I'm gonna buy this program. And I started clipping videos and put together a PowerPoint with Adam St. John and the ATF Fire Research Lab, Derek Alconis, and all the UL NIST stuff, and I made a PowerPoint called Preventing the Mayday. So it built on top of the system that we had come up with, and then we did Preventing the Mayday. And then once I got there, everything just snowballed for me career-wise. So we had got Fire Crew of the Year for that. We had Firefighter of the Year before that. So it was getting recognized that we were making progress in the fire service. And we started teaching it in the academies, and then all of a sudden I got into, nozzle work and fire behavior, and it just continuously snowballed throughout. And then getting into Fire Nuggets, which we could talk about a little bit, the network that I've established over the years, the friendships, were just totally outstanding. And that allowed me to stay a little bit ahead, for the last several years, which has been really nice.
Okay. With that being said, you notice the deficiency, right? Within your organization, you're like, hey, definitely you learn from an incident. The next department over, really close, hits home for everybody. So you notice some deficiencies and you went out there and you put in the work and you're like, hey, this is what we collectively need to do. With that being said, every organization believes that they can handle whatever gets thrown at them until they get kicked in the mouth, right? But with you bringing that up, did you have any issues where now a spotlight, a microscope, a target was set on you?
Not at that point, but after the fire behavior stuff, a little bit, I think. So it and a lot of this was my fault. So I had to self-reflect. I had to look in the mirror. It took me a minute to figure it out. But and I'll use Simek Sinek as an example. I was okay with the finite wins. I'm gonna shove this down your throat because we need to change, right? So when I came up with that Preventing the Mayday PowerPoint, which was fire behavior, right? Learning flow path and air track and stuff like that. Collectively, again, we formed a committee in Mesa and we did a modern fire behavior flip. Right. And the pendulum swung a little too far, like it, pretty common. And then a lot of miscommunication in how it was presented. So we had some growing pains there as well. But like I said, I was able to stay ahead. So when I started going to these conferences and learning, nozzle forward techniques, learning gaining relative superiority from Brian Brush, learning different, forcible entry techniques. For me, I wanted to bring all this information back, but my organization wasn't ready for it all, not all at once, right? So I'm like, F you guys, I'm going to push this down your throat. We need to switch our ground ladders. Our search culture sucks. Our ground ladder culture sucks. What are you guys doing? You're incompetent. Your tactics are a mess. And I didn't win any friends. And so, that being said, I at that point, I had a target on my back. And one of the guys said, "Hey, dude, you're a martyr." So I'll just put it like this way. One of my chiefs, who is still there, so I won't mention their name, doesn't like me at all as far as our training division goes. So they pulled me aside and said, "I'm not allowed to teach at my department because I teach dangerous stuff, and nobody wants to come work with me." Right? That's what I was told. So I was like, well, what kind of dangerous stuff? You mean the stuff that's in, Fire Engineering Magazine that I get to teach all over the country and now is taught in every regional fire academy here? But they're just not willing to grow. You know what I mean? And again, I got to self-reflect and I didn't give them the why, right? This person doesn't have that much experience on an engine. They promoted really rapidly, and I didn't do myself any favors by not including them and telling them why. But so now I'm no longer allowed to teach or host any conferences in my city. So I teach in a place called Golder Ranch. And do we get here through Maddie Brown? Is that how you got my name?
I got your name through Maddie Brown and also Chief Bob Reiser.
Okay, Bob's great. So, and so is Matt. Like, I love him. But I think Matt was in the class
He was.
in Golden Ranch. And so they sent my training chief, sent my training division, and the next city over their training division to my class in Golden Ranch, gave them overtime, company cars, paid for their hotels because I'm not allowed to teach it in my city.
To
Right.
this day, still.
To this day. Yeah. So, another reason why I promote is because now I can run my battalion and I can do battalion level training. So it's a little easier to swallow. I'm still not invited out to the academy, to teach some of these hands-on stuff. So it's all, third party. And these guys do a great job anyway. So I'm not disappointed in that because that's that infinite game where if it's just me, it's never going to work. But whole collectively, it works much better. And we get into that. I just had coffee before this with my friend Dave Coulson from Glendale. And we talked about that because that was a vision that I had back then. But yeah, so they sent our training divisions 2 hours away, got them a hotel when I could have done it for free, for them anytime. But it was just weird. And a lot of that, again, I have to self-reflect and say, hey, this is probably not all on them. My delivery was crap, right? So
And
we could have done better.
I get that. Trust me, because I've had my own little I've had an incident where hell here recently, me and a buddy of mine, we aided in instructing to get our search culture better than it needs to be. Okay, I'll
Right.
be fully transparent on that. And in a classroom setting, we instructed all three shifts. So one of the shifts I had mentioned that our engine company culture used to be like subpar, like it was decent. And with the we had several individuals who were like, hey, we've got some deficiencies here. This is what we need to do. And collectively, they have definitely gotten us where our engine company culture is strong. And I use the words, and I did say this, our ladder company, we've had a ladder captain who's been trying for many, many years to go, hey, listen, our ladders need to be aggressive when throwing ground ladders when we're on the second floor. Every single side of the structure needs to have a ladder. Our search culture needs to be aggressive. He's been fighting that battle. And so I mentioned that our search culture, and I use the word our search culture sucked. And that triggered Captain, who was like, well, what do you mean our search culture sucks? Like, explain to me, because he had a hand in, and when I was going through recruit class, going through the department, he taught search. And so I understand how he took it. He kind of took it as I was saying the way I was taught sucked. And that's not what I meant. What I should have said was we have deficiencies, but I didn't. I used the wrong word and I wholeheartedly admit that. But people also need to realize, like, number one, you don't know what you don't know. And like, I just can't understand how firemen can't be. How they can't look at themselves in the mirror and be like, hey, yeah, we need to do better. We can do better on this search stuff. So I just find it crazy that even though what you're doing is 100% right now, you have other organizations, third parties coming in and teaching it, that you're still not allowed. Like, I just, to me, what's the point of that? Like, it makes no sense.
Yeah, so it's getting a little better now that I'm BC. So because I pull in my battalion every 3 months or so, I pull in my battalion for company training. I started off with weapon selection. Here's the weapons we have on our truck, which Brian Brush started and allowed me to be one of his instructors for Exponential Engine. So we started that. We teach it all over the country. So we do weapon selection. We did a couple fire reviews that we've had near misses on. One I wasn't involved with, but I'm friends with all of them. The other one I was involved with in an industrial fire that I had no idea some of the reports. So I had to get with the crews and talk about like, hey, how come you didn't mention there was a 4-foot bat of molted rubber in here? How come you didn't mention that you guys were getting shocked until afterwards because of the solar panels and lack of grounding? How come you didn't mention the exposed energy panels with 600 volts that are wide open being cooled with a fan? How come you didn't mention the chemicals, the barrels, and God forbid the huge boiler in there, right? So as I see, I was not aware of any of this until after the fact, right? And I'm like, hey, we just don't fight industrial fires. And one of my captains said, hey, we always use the old adage, don't bring, residential tactics to commercial fires. But we never talk about not bringing commercial tactics to industrial fires. They're different animals, you know? So, and we have everything here. So in one day, I was division, we call them sectors, but division 15 on a high-rise fire in Tempe. The minute I came down and put my pack away, we have drivers for we call them BSOs, battalion safety officers. And he's like, hey man, get in the truck. I was like, what did I do? He goes, we got another commercial fire over here. Target's on fire. So I was like, all right. So I jump in. I'm like, no way we're going to be first in. He's driving fast. So we pull in, and sure enough, we're first in right after a high rise fire, a working high rise fire in Division 15. Now I'm IC of a target fire that's arson in an occupied target. So I'm like, oh, here we go. So it's been an interesting journey, but I know one of the things we talked about is aggressive, right?
Yes,
That's
yes.
one of the things we talked about. You just use that term. And our search culture sucking and our groundwater culture sucks, so we can do better with the search culture and get more aggressive. And risk is managed by competence. So, when you have ICs and crews that don't train, then your level of incompetence is higher. And you need to fix that deficiency. Our ground ladder culture, I agree with you. I think we should throw ladders until we run out of windows or run out of ladders, right? So our SOP says that our ladder companies get two means of egress, opposite ends, load-bearing walls. But what about my engine companies? Why are they afforded a different safety margin when I'm working an above-grade fire on a mid-rise or a two or three-story apartment complex? When you're not laddering those windows proactive for me, then that's a problem because the only exit that I have and the only rescue means I have is to potentially bring that victim and myself back through an IDLH where I could have isolated them in a bedroom and made a rescue out of a more advantageous part of the home, right? But I get all the time, well, we don't VES. Yes, we do. You're just incompetent, right? Yes, we absolutely will do that. And that's been an argument for a long time. Can you search off a hose line? Absolutely, you can search off a hose line if you're good at it and train, right? Don't put yourself in a dangerous position. Operate within your risk management plan, and then you can do it. To be aggressive is to take a strong, proactive approach to achieve success, right? And you're aggressively trying to achieve your tactical objectives, which is your rescue, your fire control, and your loss stopped, right? You give applicable information, you give your PARs right afterwards, you operate within your risk management plan, and your objective is to aggressively lower that risk management plan as you go through the event, right? So promoting those cultures are huge, right? You need to outline those expectations and give intent, right? If I have to hang from a window like fireground survival operations, and there's an available ladder on every single apparatus, we're having words, right? So if I got to hang my crew from a window because you didn't throw a ground ladder to division two or three, then that's a problem. So we need to aggressively lower our risk on the fire ground. And that's through aggressive suppression. It's not necessarily safety first. It's a suppression culture making the fire ground safer for us and the victim or occupants.
That's
So
well, well said. Well said. I do have a side question though. Does Mesa use is for your incident command system, does Mesa use Blue Card?
we do not, but we're very similar. So there's no agency that I know of that actually uses Blue Card in Arizona. but the incident command system that it's founded from is very, very similar. And I hear all the time, well, blue card guys don't want you to vertically ventilate. Blue card guys don't want you to, search off the hose line. In the actual curriculum, from what I've seen, it doesn't actually say that. So those are the individual instructors that may be saying that. I know some excellent, tacticians that are blue card instructors that believe in it, because it's really supposed to be the order model and the strategic part of that. What's the communication base? How do we organize this fire scene and bring organization to the chaos, right? Because the acronym for chaos, right? Chief has arrived on scene. So that's what blue card's supposed to do. It's supposed to bring clarity to chaos. So some of those individual things I think are taken out of context. But no, to answer your question, none of the regional system is technically blue card.
Okay, but from my understanding, blue card is not tactics. It's supposed to be communication.
Communication strategy. Yep.
Okay, all right. Just wanted to ask because my department uses blue card. So I had a guest on a while back, and we discussed the pros and cons to blue card. For me, there are certain things I like. The terminology, cool. If you want everybody within my organization the same terminology on the same playing field, got it.
Correct.
But like we still have certain officers who were using it as kind of like for tactics, and that's where we had some issues.
Right. That's the issue, because I don't think it's supposed to be there. And there's a dude that you may have on your show. His name is Chris Stewart. He was a Phoenix fire chief for 32 years. He's a great friend of mine. Forgotten more than I'll know about the fire service. I can connect you if you're interested. He is a blue card instructor, and he will bring light to that for sure. He's an excellent speaker, an excellent tactician, and I'm glad I can call that guy a friend. And we met through high-rise operation stuff. I started reaching out for high-rise stuff. Super intelligent dude, if you ever get a chance, but he can bring some clarity to that. So.
Okay. All right. I want to ask this next question on you noticed some deficiencies within your leadership, so you decided, hey, I'm going to step up to the BC role to maybe assist with that deficiency, kind of help create a better culture. My question to you is why? I mean, and this is a broad question and it's your opinion only, but why do we have leaders that continue to do that? You know what I mean? Like they either forget their way, forget what it's like, have really never been that firefighter to begin with, but promote so fast and they get, hey, yep, you did great on your test. Here you go, your whatever chief status. Why do we continue to have that?
Man, I wish I knew, because I've got some of those, right? They're really micromanaging. They don't allow guys to control their environment, right? And I kind of like to lead by intent or objective. You know that we're going to go interior for a search. Your job is to put your protected body in between Mrs. Smith and the problem, right? So within that risk management plan. And we could talk about that too, because that, I said it on Corley's show. So that was the biggest industrial injury we had with the Phoenix Fire Department, all the hurt feelings, because Justin McWilliams came in and said, hey, your risk management plan is subjective, right? And it is risk. We will risk a lot to save a savable life, right? Or to save a life. And it's written several different ways, right? We will risk a lot within a highly calculated manner to save a savable life. Well, what's a savable life? What's a highly calculated manner? When you get chiefs that are inbred, that don't go out to outside fire conferences, that don't put on their equipment anymore, and your job is a BC, so I see it, right? It's kind of a dichotomy, and I'll talk about that search culture a little more too. My job is a BC to bring my guys home safe. Right. And I can only go off of the reports they're giving me from in and on the building, right? Whether you're interior or cutting a hole. And I need to go out and train with them, evaluate them, give them my expectations. That's why I pull in my crews every so many months and train them. I had somebody ask me the other day, said, hey, when's the last time you had a BC Your BC pull you in for 2 hours every 3 months to train you, right? Here's the expectation. Here's, food for thought. I'm not going to tell you when to prioritize and deprioritize a water supply, but here's what stuff I'd like you to consider, right? When's the last time you had a battalion chief do that for you? And so I've got guys that I don't think they put a lot of trust in their crews. And trust is a huge word when you're in the incident command system. And it's not me trusting my crews, it's both ways. It's my crews trusting me, right? And they need to know that they have an opportunity to say, I can't do that, or I'm not comfortable doing that. And I said, that's fine, right? I'm handing you a piece of a puzzle. If you need to turn that piece to make it fit, turn it. And if that piece doesn't fit, then I'll give you a new piece, but you need to communicate that to me. I don't care, but I've got chiefs that'll, this is my way or the highway. When I'm in charge, I'm in charge. This is not a democracy, right? That's not how you want to operate on the fire ground. That's foolish and incompetent, So I think that boils down to them getting out and training, drilling, evaluating their crews, sharing their expectations, because they haven't been on a fire truck probably for a long time.
Facts.
And when you get out of touch, you're just out of touch. And now you violated that trust.
Now, when you train with your crews, you're not only just directing and pointing. I'm assuming you're also putting on the gear, the air pack, and you're getting dirty.
I was out throwing ladders with my guys the other day, right? So, and again, I'll talk about that with recruitment and retention and DEI or whatever you want to talk about, because I got a whole different view on that, right? So, but I'll throw ladders with them, I'll go flow lines with them, and then I give them the ability to say, hey, here's what I would like you guys to work on, but if you see other deficiencies, let's work on those, because I'm not with you all the time, right? If you want guidance, I'm here for you, but if not, I'm going to take you guys out of service for 2 hours today to train. I did that for my whole battalion last month. I got coverage for their units and said, I need you to do this. Here's some guidelines if you would like to operate in those. But if you have other deficiencies that you would like to work on, feel free to do that. But here's 2 hours for you that you need to make yourselves better. So.
And I can tell you from a firefighter perspective, if I have a battalion chief that's not just going to sit there, point with a stopwatch, watch, critique, hey, this is what you need. If they are actually putting themselves in there, throwing ladders, to me, I think most firefighters, when they see that, they will go the extra mile for that chief. It's easy to talk the talk and not put in any action.
For sure. And my guys are so solid, man. Like, I've got no issues in my battalion. It runs super smooth. I just empower them. I want them to do better. I care about them. So I can't think. I asked three or four people the other day. I said, since we've been doing this, can you remember a time where we've had to transition from offensive strategy to a defensive strategy? And they're like, nope. In fact, I can only think of one fire. It was a trailer fire in the middle of the night that we showed up and it was defensive, and we didn't lose any exposures. So these guys are aggressive, right? They're aggressively achieving their tactical objectives. And again, they're proactive, strong proactive to achieve that success. They know what I want. I lead by intent. An objective, my objective is to get a search on this. If there is searchable space, occupy that searchable space, right? It's not survivable space. That's up to God. Search it and put your body between there. Let me know you're going interior. You know what I mean? And tell me that searchable space. So all of this is starting to come up on the radio. And dude, I've had guys that tell me that the two biggest compliments I think I've had in my career are every time you promoted, it never changed you. Right. I've never changed my expectations
And that's
or my
big.
values, right? Because your values dictate culture. So that was an awesome compliment. And the other one was, dude, I would go through hell with a garden hose with you. Right. Those were the two biggest compliments that I've had. And One of my rookies, when I promoted, he gave me a sticker because it's something I always say. I said, "Hey, let no man's ghost return to say his training let him down." So he actually gave a sticker. It's on my BC helmet to this day. And the other helmet, or the other sticker on my helmet, is from my first engine company, Engine 204, where my engineer called me, and her name is Dina Wood. She's retired, but she said, "Chris, don't forget where you came from." And I said, "I won't. And if I do, you let me know." You know what I mean? So I was like, "All right." So those are just things that I've taken with me through my career. So.
Okay. With you being a BC and the size of your department, I understand not every organization can do that. But I always wanted to ask, and I'm going to probably start asking like battalion chiefs this, depending on their department size. When you have an incident where stuff's going sideways, do you have that crew you can look at and be like, okay, they're on scene. That's who I want. Like, do you have that ability and do you practice it where you can bypass it? I'm not going to be afraid to say it. A slug
For sure.
company for those are the go-getters. I need them here now.
Yep, I absolutely have those people. And if you are a BC worth their salt, you know who those people are, right? If Mesa Fire was a football team, I know the first 11 or 12 dudes I want, on my team. I know the dudes that I want responding to my house. And then there's the guys where I'm like, okay, I'm going to sit back for a minute and see how this unfolds, because that was my crew on Engine 10, where the chief pulled me aside and said, "Hey, I was just about to go defensive until I realized it was you guys pulling up." Right? So that's the crews that I want. And you get there through officer and company development and training, right? So those are expectations. We have MCS coming up now. I'm super looking forward to it. So, because I'm definitely throwing a loop in to identify deficiencies for my crews, and I'm excited because they're going to perform well, but I want to throw that little loop in there to go, okay, so I see where you're going with this. You know what I mean? So that's
Okay.
good.
Does Mesa have an officer development program? And if so, how important are departments? Because I've mentioned this before. It's very easy for, okay, we're going to have a couple positions open up. We're going to do a written test. We'll give you a practical simulated scenario, whatever you want to do, iPad, whatever, table talk. Okay. And then the individual passes and they go, congratulations. Here's your badge. You're a lieutenant or your captain. That's it, hands washed, and there's no officer development.
So we do, actually, we do pretty good. Some of it I think we could do better. But when you promote to engineer, you have an engineer's academy. And when you promote to captain, you have a captain's academy. And so a lot of it, though, is not tactics. So I think we need to do better there. That's where our deficiencies lie. And then the city itself has officer development classes, leadership classes, and stuff like that. And then some of the typical admin stuff as well that is mandatory to take as you promote. So yeah, we do a fairly good job at that. Always room for improvement, but yeah, we do a good job with that.
Okay. All right. I want to hit on the recruitment, retention slash DEI topic.
Okay.
What do you think the fire service can improve on? What do you think they're doing great on when it comes to all three of those? Because I have my own take on DEI, recruitment and retention, but I want to hear from you first.
So, recruitment and retention, we know it's broken, right? Right now, it's broken. And nationally, it's broken. When I got hired, there was 30 openings with 3,000 applicants. You know what I mean? So one in 300. And we just had a recruitment session, and I know Phoenix was low too. I don't have their numbers, but I think we had 500 candidates apply. Shoot, 60 of them are going to get hired. You know what I mean? And I think only 300 of those were eligible, I think is the numbers that I heard. You know what I mean? So the recruitment and retention's broken. And I believe, and I don't have a lot to support it, but a couple things. One is we don't have the people that want to work like that anymore. We don't have people that w a lot of people that want to do the blue collar down and dirty jobs, right? So whether that's industry, carpentry, framing houses, whatever, we don't have the early risers like we used to, and that's generational, right? So I'm not sure how we get that back. Now, that being said, and again, this is just my opinion, but I'm not sure some of these fire chiefs realize it's broken enough to fix it. But we control the narrative, right? And we are controlling the narrative poorly. So the dudes are putting stuff on Instagram that of them fighting fires. They're cutting holes. They're doing stuff, good and bad tactics, right? Sometimes I look at it and go, ugh! But the other times I'm like, oh, dude, that was a good video. You look at departmental videos and it's feel good stuff. Oh, we did this many car seats today, or hey, we did this for the public, and then we spin it and go, oh, by the way, we're running too many calls. Our call volume sucks, right? We got sleep deprivation. That's leading to PTSD. Firefighter and police suicide are as high as they've ever been. And by the way, you're probably going to get cancer at the end of your 20-year career. And that's all you see on social media. So why in the hell would you want to apply for this job, right? We are missing the boat, in my opinion, to where, again, when I got hired, it was chicks dig it, maybe the guys too, you know what I mean? Because you got athletic, females that have their stuff together, and you know what I mean? They're smart, they're intelligent, they passed the test, they did what they needed to do to get here, and it's a career. You don't have to worry about when you get on the fire department or police department, you have 25 or 30 years of a career where you never have to worry about anything. It's pandemic proof, it's recession proof. You know what I mean? Like, it is the best career in the world. And when I got hired, it was like that. It's action packed. We're, technical rescue. We're doing this. We're fighting these fires. And now it's, oh, you're probably going to die of cancer, bro. We can't do that. We're controlling a crappy narrative for the people that want to do it. And yet we're being more proactive than ever to counterbalance that stuff, right? So we've got two sets of turnouts. We've got some clean cabs. We're putting stuff in the station. Our decom procedures are better. Why are we continuously advertising the negatives of the job all over social media? You know what I mean? That has got to change if we want our recruitment and retention to go up, in my opinion.
No, that I mean, hell, here recently I saw a study where, okay, the hot topic right now is schedule change. Okay. And so, like my department, we just recently, for 18 years, I have worked a 24/48. I knew that coming on. That's what I signed up for. Now we've hired an influx of young individuals. Most of them are single or at least no kids. And so, hey, we want to do a schedule change. All right. So what do we go with? We had the option of the 1-3-2-3, keep it the same. It's called down here the Charlotte Fire schedule, and then 4896. 4896 was trending. It got a lot of buzz. It won. Okay. Was I in favor of it? No. Because I signed up for 24/48. That's what I was used to. I'm not saying it's the best schedule, but okay, 18 years in, what am I going to do? I can't just go, all right, I'm out of here. I'm not throwing 18 years down the drain. So I went with it. It's still too early to tell for me, but for right now, I can definitely say I don't know what person wouldn't enjoy 4 days off. I mean, but to get there, I got to get through the 48. But you hear 24/72s is gaining a lot of traction, but not a lot of departments can really either afford it, or if they can, they have to strategically plan it to make it work. But you're 100% right, because the whole sleep deprivation. But here's the thing. I, as an adult, and I wasn't an adult, I'm not gonna say I was an adult. When I got hired, I was 21. So I was very young, naive. I just saw, ooh, full time? Sure. Money? Awesome. A steady paycheck coming in every week? Sign me up. But as I got older, it was like, okay, I knew this is what I signed up for. Okay. There are going to be nights where we don't sleep. There are going to be nights or days where we're run ragged. Fires happen in all seasons of weather. So, like, I 100% agree with the fact that we keep promoting the negative. I mean, I don't want to die of cancer, but it's a well-known fact. Hey, there's a hazardous to this job. So what I do, I make sure I wash my turnout gear. I don't want to look salty. I don't care what the pictures say. When I come out of a fire, I'm not going to take my gloves and wipe my, like, I don't want to have all that soot. That stuff's not cool. Back when I was a volunteer, smelling that structure fire in your gear, you're like, ooh, rite of passage. Now look at it. That was just fucking dumb. Like,
Right.
you know what I'm saying? But as we get older, like, I have a problem where, you know, as firefighters, we're supposed to be adults, but people do not act like adults. It's like you signed up for whatever the case may be. I'm not saying there shouldn't be progression, but come on, like, let's
For
be
sure.
real about certain things.
Yep, absolutely, without a doubt. That's another challenge with our system because we do a 3-4 Kelly, so Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and then have Saturday, Sunday, Monday, off or whatever. Phoenix does a 24-48, and Gilbert does a 48-96. So trying to get everybody on that same schedule is difficult, especially for training. Yeah, that's another big one is we're advertising negatives all the time. We need to stop it. If we want our recruitment and retention to go up, we need to stop. Now, this is where probably everybody's going to turn off this podcast because I'm going to say we need DEI. And now I'm going to explain it. So don't turn it off yet. I think the narrative that we pushed where we're hiring incompetent people, for the position just because we need to meet a quota, I'm not sure that's right.
Right,
Right.
right.
So, I have some women on my department that I absolutely love, and I would take them over a lot of men, right? So that being said, I'll move on to diversity. We 100% need diversity in the fire service, right? And so my partner is from Mazatlan. So he's actually he now he's a United States citizen, but when he got hired, he was not. His second language is English, and he spent a lot of time learning it. He was my rookie firefighter, and now he's my partner at drives me in the BC ride. He's been so valuable on calls because we have a heavy Spanish speaking area, right? You need that diversity. Mesa is heavy Mormon in the religion to the point when I got hired, I walked into the station and I said, "Hey, what room's open?" They go, "Hey, are you Mormon?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Well, you're on this side of the station because it's the bros and the mos." Right, that's the way it used to be. So when I get to these calls, and they have a different religious background, and they say, "Hey, I had these people hovered over my patient, and I can't make access to them because they're saying a prayer, and they have a prayer oil for a blessing." Well, it's really nice to have a Mormon person on my crew to understand what that was. Hey, I'm going to take this. I'm in this ward. Let me fix this for you. We're able to provide a better external customer service. So diversity is all over the map, right? Whether it's religion, race, color, creed, or just a language barrier. We absolutely need diversity, right? Equity. Sweat equity is where it's at. You need to earn your keep. And so I'm going to throw this girl's name out here. She's brand new. I don't know if she'll listen to the podcast, but I'll make her. Her name is Tatum, right? She's 19 years old. She doesn't have a lot of experience outside the fire service. This may very well be her, it's definitely her first career, right? So Tatum is a smaller girl, and arguably, she, my chief is a female and she's wonderful. But she wanted to make a large part of our organization female. I think she said like 30% by 2030, right? So a lot of these would be considered a DEI hire. And I told Tatum this the other day. I get the argument, well, Tatum's not going to be able to pull a 300 man out of a building or a 300-pound man out of a building. Neither am I. Right. I'm 52 years old. Sure, I'm in decent shape and I might be able to pull a little further, but let's focus on our strengths, not our weaknesses. So when I look at the equity part of that, I'm watching Tatum throw ground ladders the other day, and she's struggling with a 14, 16-foot ladder. She's short like me, I'm only 5'7", and so the throw on the ladder is a little bit long for her. So I walk out and I say, "Hey, can I help you with that?" And I was like, "Go take off your gear." So I said, she goes, "Really?" I go, "Yeah, go take it all off except for your gloves, right? So I'm not worried about your helmet right now." I said, "Tatum, you can either be stressed or you can be learning, but you can't be both. So, and if you're mentally stressed because your chief is out here working with you right now, relax, right? Because we're going to get you through it. If you're physically stressed because all of that gear and this is a new technique for you, get rid of it. We're going to start from scratch." So I watched her do it a couple times and changed her hand placement, and she threw the ladder, and the excitement on her face when that ladder stuck, it looked like she smoked weed for the first time. She's like, "Whoa." And I'm like, "That's awesome." So, she did it a couple more times, and she's putting in equity to the department. It's the sweat equity to belong, the cultural values and the ethos. She's putting it together right now. She has equity. And the I part of that is, inclusion. That equity gives her the inclusion. But I look at that I for her is inspiration. She inspires to be a better person. She inspires to work better. And she inspires to make her crew better. So when I look at DEI, I can say, sure, you're a DEI hire because you're a female, Tatum, or because you meet this demographic. But screw that. She's putting in all the effort, more effort than some of the dudes to make herself better. And there's a lot of that, right? This is not just isolated to her. This is, if you're willing to put in the sweat equity, if you're willing to give us inspiration to make you, your crew, and the organization better, to provide better internal and external customer service, I don't give a crap if you're transgender, white, black, female, whatever. Do your job, right? And if you are deficient, then I am proud of you as an individual to make that effort to make yourself better. So all of those things, I think we need DEI, but I would change that to diversity, ethos, and inspiration, right? It's all of those things that are my DEI hire, because we are physically and mentally of incapable of doing everything on this job,
Right.
right? And that's just the bottom line. So focus on your strengths and how you can be of value to our organization. And she is the epitome of that. And I'm just using that as the most recent example. But, I think we need that for our recruitment and for our retention is guys like her captains, her crews, myself as her battalion chief going out and putting in the effort to make her better, right? And to make me better. Because once I talk to her and say, "Hey, throw this ladder like this. Once you got it, hey, now go put on your helmet." And the reason why I picked your helmet is because you got to clear it a little bit more with this throw. Okay, now go put on your coat. And the coat is going to restrict this a little bit. And then now take a break. And tomorrow start again. When you can throw it again next shift, then start building up until you have all your gear. So a week later, I walk back out and she misses a stick and she's in full equipment now, the whole deal, and she misses it and she's frustrated and she's trying to go fast. And I was like, "Hey, you're doing everything right." I said, "You hear that adage, slow is smooth and smooth is fast. That's great for training and developing muscle memory, but then slow is just slow, right? It's just slow. So we need to put a clock to it once we develop that muscle memory." So when I give her these tools, now she's full turned out and she tries to stick it. She misses it. I'm like, "It's okay." Because it's like when I taught my daughter how to snow ski when she's, French fries pizza going down the slope. She gets it and she's not going that fast. She's skiing in control. But when I take her up on the blues and now she has to pizza French fries a little quicker or make those inputs a little faster, of course she's going to fall. Right? You now need to move that tool a little bit quicker for the speed that you're going at. So keep practicing what you're doing. The fundamentals are there. Just keep practicing what you're doing. And she continuously does that. There was a, I said, a proud dad moment the other day. We had a structure fire, and I was teaching them how to flow a 2.5 inch hand line solo. But I also teach them how to clamp it and flow it with just their feet while they're masking up. And so I watch her on this trailer fire. She pulls an inch and three quarter. She literally has it flowing through the window, doing that transitional attack or an exterior attack while she's masking up. And then she picks up the hose line and transitions interior. So she doesn't stop that flow of water. And from, you know, the zero impact period from parking brake the water on the fire was significantly faster because she's doing it, you know, while she's masking up and flowing at the same time. So I'm like, I don't care if you're considered a DEI hire or not. You have all of those aspects. You have you're the diversity, you have the ethos, and you have the inspiration to be better. So
Okay. I like how you stated it. And I'll preface it by saying to true firefighters that are there to do the job, all they want is that partner or that next fellow brother or sister that feels the same way. Like
put in the effort.
I've never met one that cares what you look like, whatever the case, we're all different. We all have different personalities, we all have different quirks about ourselves. And at the end of the day, true firemen don't care what you look like. My issue I have is when organizations pass over good candidates because they're trying to fit a criteria.
Of course, that's where we screw up the narrative, right?
Yes,
Yep,
yes. And
that's
you
where
know,
we screw up the narrative.
for me coming into the fire service, I've known the fire service historically has predominantly always been white males. Like, I'm okay with that. There's nothing wrong with it. So I don't like also hearing where we want to look like we want the department to look like the community. Okay, but I'm here to say that if the diversity hire you want to come work for you, they will find you. I
For sure.
did. You know what I'm saying? Like, you don't need to go seek out, hey, let's go into these like low income, aka hood areas, to try to find these individuals. They will find you if they
For sure.
truly want to be in the fire service, police, EMS, whatever. They will find you. You do not have to make a special trip, a special request out there. But please do not skip over good individuals,
Most
even
qualified
if
candidate.
exactly the most qualified candidates, because you want a checklist. Because what's going to happen is you're going to hire that individual that's not going, they're not going to get it. Because that's the thing about the fire service. Not everybody can do this job. I hope that people understand that. Like, if you're in this field and you're like, man, blood bothers me, or this bothers me, or that bothers me, you need to have a reality and go, hey,
I'll be not
maybe
your
this
field.
ain't for me, and bow
Right.
out. And if you do, most people will respect you. Like, hey, they tried it, it wasn't for them, they graciously bowed out. Not, hey, I have a liability on engine three today. You know what I'm saying? Like, it just, we need to be, at the end of the day, the biggest thing is sometimes firefighters need to be adults. And
Good,
what
for sure.
kills me is when they preach to their children, hey, grow up. Life's not going to be this. Life's not going to be that. You got to put in the work. It's the same damn thing for the fire service, whether it's training, whether it's leadership. You got to play how you talk.
Right, for
Makes
sure.
sense. You know what I
Absolutely.
mean? You can't just keep this and that. Hey, practice, practice, practice. But when it comes to, I don't want to do that anymore, or that's above me, I don't need to do that anymore. Like, to me, that's where you lose a lot of firefighters, especially if you're a company officer, battalion chief, and up. You can't talk the talk and, hey, it's my way or the highway. Like, you're not going to get any respect.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely not. You can't do that. And unfortunately, I have chiefs like that. I had bosses like that. And I'm like, yeah, this isn't gonna work, right? So, but we can get past that. But like Bruno said, egos eat brains, you know, and
Absolutely.
it's that, but
Okay. So I always like to ask the guests before. Oh, actually, no, hold on. I almost missed this topic because I want to hit on it because I want to hear your input. Outside training, how important is it for organizations, individuals to get outside of their bubble?
You have to get outside your bubble, right? So that's one of the big things for us. And again, we're inbred fire departments, and I don't know, we're trying. I think I'd like to think we're trying to get better. And I was the president of an organization called the Fire Nuggets for several years, which is awesome. It's a nonprofit, for firefighters by for firefighters. It is all volunteer, a bunch of dudes at, from all over the place, really. Berkeley, Arizona, Idaho, Cal. We're from all over, at least the E board. We've got guys from, San Francisco, from Boise and stuff like that. And then from Jeff Bryant is in Aurora,
Illinois.
Illinois.
I know that
So
because by this time the episode, his episode will be released by then, but I interviewed him.
perfect. Yeah. So Brent, or I mean Jeff, he took over the presidency right after I did, and I took over after David Sprague. But outside training is huge, right? So Fire Nuggets, we host probably 20 major conferences a year. Mile High, Pacific Northwest, some in Phoenix that some of the Phoenix chiefs try to shut down. You know what I mean? But we host a lot of those, and probably 100 classes or more a year. So, and it's all guys that are bringing different information from different demographics, different response models, and it's a buffet. Right. So I was asked what my favorite conference was. And I said, I don't really have a favorite conference. You just need to seek out the information you want to seek because everybody's on a circuit, right? Like I've taught at Firemanship, Mile High, Lake Effect, H Rock, all of those. So if you want to learn what I have to teach, then you just look up and see where those people are teaching, like Mark Von Appen doing leadership or Frank Lieb, or I can name drop forever. So it's not just the conference, it's the information you want to seek, whether it's high mise, mid rise, stuff like that, leadership. But outside training is super valuable, I think. And you have to get out of your box, and training's evolving so quickly. The information is out there like never before, and but you have to vet some of it too, right? So
Absolutely,
like I
yes.
said, I've seen some instructors on Instagram, and I'm like, what are you doing? You know what I mean? Like that's not a thing. So you need to vet some of it as well. I think if you don't get to outside training, you are absolutely doing your organization a disservice. You have to also have an avenue to bring that back, right? What is your organization willing to digest and change? So you'll bring back some heavy hitters like I was at first, and then all of a sudden you just get pushback, right? Like my class, when I teach the exponential engine or that type of stuff, when firefighters take that class and go back to their chiefs, they now want to change hose loads, which changes operations. They want to change their nozzles, which changes their budget, right? Now it's got to go through their resource division. What do we do with our old stuff? We've got to do, okay, you're switching from triple load to Minuteman. Now that affects our training division. So when you take a little 4-hour class or an 8-hour class like that, understand the information that you bring back, your department might not be willing to digest. So maybe take the time to talk to the instructors afterwards and say, how do I implement this in my organization? And what steps would you take? Because we've probably experienced it or answered those questions in maybe our own organizations, like I did. You know what I mean? So I was told at one point, like, hey, guys love your class. Chiefs hate it because they know it's going to cost them money and cost them a lot of time. So if you're going to do the outside training, you've got to do some legwork and start with why. This is why it's better. Not that we're doing it wrong in the first place, but we can be more efficient and we can deliver a better customer service package, not only externally, but internally. And this is why. So.
Okay, love it. So you're 10 months away from retirement. So my question I always like to ask the guests is, I phrase it. I always ask the question, where would you like to see yourself before you decide to hang it up? But right now you're a BC, and I don't believe you have any plans to go higher because you only got 10 months left. But looking back at your career, are you satisfied with how everything went, and what does the future look like for you?
Man, I would like to say yeah. I've definitely cleared some hurdles. I pushed a rock uphill for a little while, and I would love to say I would have made better decisions, but honestly, it's made me grow as an individual, made me mature a little bit through the years, and I take the time to self-reflect and say, yeah, a lot of this was my fault, right? I can understand why the chief did that at that time. Now, I don't know if their egos would get out of the way, some of them, you know what I mean, to accept that answer. But I'm glad I did what I did. I'm glad I made the push. Regionally, I see guys that are using tactics that I brought in 2014, 2000, you know, all the way from 2014 up, that I know that nobody was teaching those tactics or task level stuff, and they may never ever know where it came from, but it's cool to see that I know that I had a little seed in there to plant it, and somebody, like, you know, the Dave Colsons in Glendale, the Tammy, her name is not Goff anymore, but Tammy, she's an RTO in Glendale, Dan LaFond, they took my class and they're like, hey, driving there, we said, I think I'm about to waste 3 days of my life. And in 30 minutes into the class, they're like, man, I just didn't know what I didn't know. And I'm a, you know, they thought they were like, what did I do to the last 15 years of my career? So, my idea back then, though, when I started the class in State Fire School, is not to make this Mesa exclusive. I got amazing people from every department and brought them in as instructors. And I said, now it's contagious, right? So they may ne never know that I had anything to do with bringing nozzle forward tactics here. Never know that I had anything to do with bar-to-bar tactics from Sam Hittle. You know, never know that attack over supply and the 2.5 inch, you know, movement stuff came from Brian Brush, but I'm the one that brought it out in 2000 and, you know, 12 or 14 or whatever. But I'm watching this happen and develop around the valley, knowing that at some point somebody believed in my message and spread it, or their message, you know, because I guess it's not my message, it's Brian Brush's message, Aaron Fields, Sam Hettles. And I believed in them and I brought it here to Arizona, the region, and now it's, you know, it's spreading. And had I kept that in Mesa, it's gonna fail, right? So, but it's cool to see now that you know, Phoenix Fire started a couple years ago. There's a couple heavy hitters in Phoenix that are trying to make some change right now. And I'd laughed. I was like, dude, we started that 10 years ago in Mesa, you know, but they're doing great things there now to improve, which is awesome.
And as far as the future holds, when you do hang it up for the last time, what's next for you?
So I don't know, man. I kind of would like to go to work for MES or SureSales, one of those companies, just because I have friends there, you know, Barry Richardson and MES. I'm hoping to meet with him and see if I can do something in the sales part, partially because I want to stay involved in the fire service. And with, you know, doing stuff like the exponential engine, we can talk about how to make your engine companies more efficient, you know, work within, you know, budget constraints, training restraints, and get out there and say, hey, this equipment might be better for you, and this is why. So, you know what I mean? This hose might be better for you, this nozzle, because you run two-person engine companies with 750 gallons. You don't have the ability to get, you know, resources there quickly. Hey, why don't you consider a 2.25 with this rather than a 2.5, because it's 80 pounds lighter per 100 feet, and we can train you on this to make it happen. So I think it'll give me an avenue to stay in involved with the kitchen table in the fire service, because that's the best part about our job, you know, and still make the fire service as a whole better. And I'll do that for a couple of years before I decide to hang it up.
Okay. All right. With that being said, Chief, I appreciate you coming on. I've enjoyed this conversation. I hope the listeners have as well. But the biggest thing I like about you is you've mentioned, you learned a plethora and you continue to learn a plethora of information, but your delivery towards your own organization wasn't the greatest. But the fact that you admit it, you accept it, and you've learned from it just shows that's what I'm trying to promote more. Like, we don't know it all. Yes, there are things all of our organizations can improve on, but if we want change, it has to be done tactfully, it has to be done respectfully. But ultimately, though, individuals need to understand you're not perfect. We're not all going to be perfect in every aspect of the fire service, and we need to learn that there's also room for improvement within ourselves.
Always room for improvement, you know, and training is going to continue to evolve, you know, officer training, whether it's realistic, whether it's computer based, you know, augmented reality, AI is going to come into play here soon. You know, sky's the limit with some of this stuff. So it's going to be an amazing change. The fire service is going to pass me up, you know, in the next 10 years. It's cool to watch to everything that's evolving like it is. Hopefully our recruitment and retention will get better. You know, with some of that being getting involved with drones and robotics, we might ha see a whole new different demographic of people interested in the fire service with that. So we'll see.
Okay. I just have to say thank you for taking the time out of your day to do this. I thoroughly have enjoyed this.
Yeah, my pleasure, man. Anytime. So thanks. It's been an honor. So,
Yes, sir. Thank you.
yep, my pleasure.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.